And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kovi Tapai, and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran condemns the latest U.S. sanctions that target the country's foreign trade, saying Washington is addicted to instrumental use of sanctions. The United States says it has killed the Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in a drone strike in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, over the weekend. And Iraqi protesters take to the streets of the capital Baghdad to voice their anger at the occupation of the parliament by supporters of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Thank you for joining us. A top story this hour, Iran has condemned the latest round of U.S. sanctions targeting the country's foreign trade, saying addiction to sanctions is an indicator of America's hegemonic system. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said the new bans prove that a change in U.S. administrations does not change the country's sanctions policy. Nasser Kanani said the administration of Joe Biden still sticks to the failed maximum pressure policy of his predecessor, even amid the ongoing efforts to revive the 2015 deal. He added that Tehran will take a firm and immediate measure to minimize the negative impact of such bans on the country's trade and economy. His remark came earlier on Monday. The U.S. blacklisted 6 companies that it claimed helped Iran export petrochemicals to East Asia. They included 3 Hong Kong-based trading companies, an Emirati firm, and 2 shipping companies. Iran says it is set to bring online hundreds of new centrifuges, including the advanced IR-1 and IR-6 machines. The spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran said the move is in line with a law passed by the parliament to counter the sanctions imposed on the country over its peaceful nuclear program. Behrouz Kamalvandi said the move is also part of the efforts to raise Iran's uranium enrichment capacity to 190,000 SWU, which he described as the country's minimum requirement. Kamalvandi stressed that the International Atomic Energy Agency has been notified of Iran's decision. He said the new centrifuges have already been installed and it will take between 10 to 15 days for 500 IR-6 machines to become operational. the United States says it has killed the Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in an airstrike in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. The announcement was made by the U.S. President Joe Biden, who claimed there have been no civilian casualties. He called Zawahiri a vicious and determined killer. The Al-Qaeda leader was killed in a CIA drone strike on his residence over the weekend. The Taliban government has confirmed the strike. It condemned the strike as a violation of international principles and the 2020 agreement on the U.S. withdrawal. Zawahiri was a suspected mastermind of the September 11, 2001 attacks, which killed nearly 3,000 people in the United States. He took over Al-Qaeda after its original leader, Osama bin Laden, was killed by U.S. special forces in Pakistan in 2011. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the United States intends to divert attention from its wrong policies by announcing it killed the Al-Qaeda leader.
I think this is something that the United States is doing because of the desperation that it finds itself in on the chessboard of international operations, diplomacy, and military operations. But false flag events are meant to distract the population away from considering and analyzing other potentially damaging political events, such as China, such as the war in Ukraine, such as the $60 billion that Biden has been giving to Ukraine and a massive money laundering operation, such as the war crimes that the U.S. has been aiding and abetting, both in the murder of Ukrainian prisoners of war with the HIMAR missile systems, as well as the biological and chemical weapons factory that the U.S. was developing in Ukraine from 2005 to 2019, essentially, to develop biological chemical weapons targeting the Slavic Russian DNA. All of that paperwork is coming out. So, notoriously, the West gets very nervous when it begins to get scrutinized and examined from international theaters. Of course, the West is the originator of the destabilization and the endless terror wars.
Hundreds of Iraqis take to the streets of the capital, Baghdad, to voice their anger at the occupation of the parliament by supporters of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr for the third consecutive day. The protest is taking place outside the high-security green zone, with some carrying placard reading, "The people will not allow a coup." Security forces have set up roadblocks in a bid to contain the counter-protests. Last week, Sadr supporters breached the green zone twice. They first stormed parliament, and 3 days later they began a sit-in inside the building. They are opposed to the prime ministerial nomination by a rival political faction, the Coordination Framework, an alliance led by Sadr won most seats in the 2021 parliamentary elections. But in June, the cleric asked his MPs to resign after failing to form a government. Israeli forces have shot dead another Palestinian youth during a nighttime raid on Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 17-year-old Zirar Riyad al-Kafrini was declared dead on arrival at hospital after being shot in the chest. Another Palestinian was also injured. The casualties came after the Israeli army and undercover forces raided Jenin refugee camp to arrest a senior commander of the Islamic Jihad movement. Israeli forces launched almost daily raid and arrest operations in the West Bank, which often result in casualties. Israeli forces have killed at least 55 Palestinians since late March, mostly in the West Bank. Over the past few days, it's been revealed that a charitable fund run by Britain's Prince Charles accepted a large donation from a questionable Saudi family in 2013. News of the seven-figure donation from members of Osama bin Laden's family was first reported by centre-right newspaper The Sunday Times. As Saidpur Reza reports, controversial donations of this kind to the Prince's charities are not without precedent.
Prince Charles, Britain's heir to the throne, in yet more hot water for accepting questionable donations to his charitable fund, this time from a family whose name brings back horrifying memories. Bakr and Shafiq bin Laden, wealthy construction magnates and half-brothers of the dead Al-Qaeda terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, reportedly donated $1.7 million to a charitable fund that the prince is the patron of.
The future king allegedly greenlighted the donation after meeting one of the bin Laden brothers in the palatial building known as Clarence House in 2013, only 2 years after U.S. Special Forces killed a 9/11 mastermind in the east of Pakistan.
The prince's office denies any wrongdoing, saying the decision to accept the money was made by the fund's trustees. To those observing the royal family for years, something bigger is at play.
What I think is happening is, in Britain at the moment, we're in a transition going from the Elizabethan age, if you will, to a new era in the royal family, which is Prince Charles. And I think what they're doing is cleaning out the closet and getting rid of any skeletons which could shadow or cast a shadow over his accession to the throne.
In February, claims of a cash for honor scandal involving a Saudi businessman, a police investigation into another of Charles's charitable foundations ensued. And before that, reports that between 2011 and 2015, the prince accepted donations totaling $3.2 million to his charity from a former Qatari prime minister, with the cash delivered in shopping bags.
The optics aren't good. And if this money was being received in the Kremlin or in Tehran or another country that's at odds with the West, you can imagine the outcry and the pompous invective that would be spouted towards those countries.
It remains to be seen if the prince will be investigated over this latest revelation. And with an upcoming documentary featuring the life of his deceased former wife, Princess Diana, scrutiny of the 73-year-old royal will intensify. Saeed Purza, London.
The U.S. has announced a new tranche of weapons worth $550 million for Ukraine, including ammunition for advanced rocket systems and artillery guns. Announcing the new package, Washington said it will continue to work with its allies and partners to provide Ukraine with key capabilities. This brings the total military assistance to Ukraine since President Joe Biden took office to more than $8.8 billion. Apart from financial and military aid, the U.S. has also imposed a wide range of sanctions on Moscow over the war in Ukraine. Russian officials, including President Vladimir Putin, have warned that the continued supply of Western weapons will only prolong the war. Russian forces have so far destroyed large depots of U.S. and European weapons supply to Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has issued a stark warning about the possibility of a nuclear war, saying there could be no winners in such a war. Putin made the remark while addressing the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. He added that a nuclear war, quote, should never be unleashed. Putin also reiterated Russia's full commitment to the letter and spirit of the treaty. Addressing the same conference, the UN Secretary General warned that humanity is just one step, misunderstanding or miscalculation, away from nuclear annihilation. Antonio Guterres added that the world faces a nuclear danger not seen since the height of the Cold War. He said eliminating nuclear weapons is the only guarantee that they will never be used. The conference comes amid simmering tensions between the West and Russia over the war in Ukraine. The United States says House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has the right to visit Taiwan despite warnings by China. The White House National Security Council spokesman says Washington sees no reason for Beijing to turn a planned visit to Taiwan into a crisis. John Kirby also says the U.S. policy toward Taiwan remains unchanged. The U.S. House Speaker is now on a tour of East Asia. She would become the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit Taiwan if her trip goes ahead. China has warned the U.S. over the visit, saying Washington is playing with fire. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory and opposes Washington's growing engagement with Taipei. And finally, people around the world are observing the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, who is the third Shia Imam for Shia Muslims. In Iran, mass mourning ceremonies are held each year to commemorate Imam Hussein's sacrifices for saving Islam. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The story of love. Love for a man who lived 14 centuries ago, but continues to inspire Muslims. He is Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. Every year on his martyrdom anniversary, Iranians get dressed in black and participate in mass mourning ceremonies to pay tribute to their Imam.
Imam Hussein is a symbol of courage and resistance in the face of cruelty and bullying. On the outside, he was oppressed, but in fact, his martyrdom exposed the fact that the ruler of the time was against Islam and the teaching of the Prophet.
After 14 centuries, Imam Hussein is still touching the hearts and minds of Muslims. This is because of the sacrifices he made for Islam. So every year, we participate in such ceremonies to preserve his ideology.
Imam Hussein was the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. Based on Islamic references, the Shia Imam and 72 of his companions were killed in 680 AD in modern-day Iraqi city of Karbala by the forces of the second Umayyad Caliph, Yazid. The asymmetrical battle was triggered after Imam Hussein refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, for he believed that the Caliph did not exercise true Islam, as taught by the Prophet.
Yazid was a corrupt ruler who indulged in alcohol and lavished money on his personal pleasure. He exercised racial and gender discrimination during his rule.
Imam Hussein felt duty-bound to stand against Yazid to prevent Islam from going astray. Our Imam said he wanted to revive the same version of Islam that was introduced by his grandfather, Prophet Muhammad.
Imam Hussein's sacrifices made him a lasting figure in Islam and a symbol of resistance. That's why Shia Muslims never miss out on the 10-day mourning ceremonies to play their part in keeping Imam Hussein's legacy alive and thank him for saving Islam from distortion and manipulation.
To these people, Imam Hussein was a true freedom seeker to whom justice mattered more than his life. And this is just one reason why the blazes of his love never die down in the hearts of Muslims after 14 centuries. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Dozens of Afghan and African refugees are sleeping rough on the streets of Brussels while Ukrainians are afforded preferential treatment. Now conditions for those homeless asylum seekers have worsened. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Discarded food along with human waste surround people sleeping on the street outside Belgium's largest asylum application centre at Le Petit Château in Brussels. It's the first day of August at 7 a.m. and families with young children wait outside for the facility to open its doors.
People that are sleeping a few days already in the street, they don't have anything, they are sleeping in the ground, there is no toilet, there is no food, there is some volunteers that are here bringing food for the people.
I'm from Afghanistan. I've been sleeping on the street here for 25 days. When I queue for hours to get into the center, I'm told there is no help available yet.
As was highlighted by us 3 weeks ago, these desperate people are mainly from Afghanistan and African nations. Nighttime temperatures in Belgium at present are roughly late teens, early 20s degrees Celsius, so of course you can survive. But for example, it did rain last night, and so the conditions here are appalling. And it won't be long before temperatures begin to drop.
Today is a nice day. It's not raining. The temperature's pleasant. I've been here in the middle of winter, when there's snow on the ground and it's freezing cold, and they have the same reception.
It's a different story for Ukrainian refugees. The EU says there is no limit on the number who can enter the 27-nation bloc. They are guaranteed housing, schooling for children and social welfare payments. We raised this apparent discrimination with the European Commission during an online press conference.
As regards the reception capacity, we continue to support the Belgian authorities in increasing their reception capacity.
And Jerome, I mean, you know full well as we do that these are responsibilities of member states.
But rights groups say the pictures speak for themselves. This situation breaks EU and international humanitarian laws. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thanks for tuning in.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
The U.S. President's recent visit to the occupied Palestinian territories paved the way for an escalated crackdown on Palestinian human rights advocates and journalists in the West Asia region. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden Helps the Zionist Regime Get Away with Murder. Here's more. The U.S. president's recent visit to the occupied Palestinian territories paved the way for an escalated crackdown on Palestinian human rights advocates and journalists in the West Asia region. During his perfunctory visit to the occupied Palestinian territories, Joe Biden said that the U.S. will continue to insist on a full and transparent accounting for the killing of journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh. He did not elaborate on what such an accounting would look like or what form Washington's insistence might take. The president's vague pledge was belied by his much more specific commitment to shield the Israeli regime from accountability. That promise was made in the Al-Quds U.S. Israeli regime strategic partnership joint declaration that he issued with Yair Lapid, the Zionist regime's prime minister, a day earlier. Integral to that pledge is Washington's commitment never to allow other countries to acquire nuclear technology, and that it is prepared to use all elements of its national power to ensure that outcome. The U.S. also pledged to seek additional missile defense assistance for the Zionist regime during exceptional circumstances, such as the Zionist regime's military offensive in Gaza in May 2021. More than 250 Palestinians in Gaza, which has been under the Zionist regime's blockade since 2007, with no end in sight, were killed during those 11 days of bombing, including at least 67 children. Around a dozen people in other parts of Palestine were also killed as a result of rocket fires during those 11 days. Palestinians lack an advanced defense system like that used by the Zionist regime to intercept rockets fired from other parts. 14 Palestinian families lost three or more members in a single attack during that offensive as the Zionist regime targeted residential buildings. UN independent human rights experts have stated that, owing to the vast asymmetry of power, the victims of this conflict are disproportionately Palestinians in Gaza. Biden pledged to perpetuate this asymmetry of power by stating that he would continue to help the Israeli regime stamp out at any and all Palestinian resistance, armed or otherwise, to Israeli regime occupation, colonization, and apartheid. Washington affirmed that it would work with Tel Aviv to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize the Israeli regime, to deny its right to self-defense, or to unfairly single it out in any forum, including at the United Nations or the International Criminal Court, ICC. That promise directly contradicts Biden's purported insistence for accountability for Shirin Abu Aghaleh. Abu Aghaleh, a U.S. citizen and veteran Al Jazeera correspondent, was fatally shot while covering an Israeli regime military raid in the West Bank city of Jenin during May. On July 4th, a major holiday in the U.S., the U.S. State Department issued a statement acknowledging that Abu Aghaleh was most likely killed by Israeli regime fire. The statement, attributed to spokesperson Ned Price, added without any elaboration that U.S. officials found no reason to believe that this was intentional. The UN Human Rights Office also concluded that Abu Aghaleh and her colleagues, who were wearing protective vests and helmets, marking them as press,
came under fire from the direction of the Israeli regime forces. But in contrast to the U.S. State Department, the Human Rights Office noted that several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them, suggesting that the shooting was deliberate. The U.S. State Department even appeared to justify the Israeli regime's military action, saying that Abu Aqile was killed as a result of tragic circumstances during an IDF-led military operation against factions, which followed a series of attacks. The joint declaration signed by Biden and Lapid implies that efforts to hold the Israeli regime accountable in international fora such as the UN and the ICC unfairly single it out. The declaration rejects the Palestinian-led movement for boycott, divestment and sanctions and, in the next sentence, says the U.S. and the Israeli regime will fight every scourge and source of anti-Semitism, implying a link between the two where there is none. The declaration also pledges to respond whenever legitimate criticism crosses over into bigotry and hatred or attempts to undermine the Zionist regime's legitimate place among family of the nations, as they claim. Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, said that the declaration is the latest continuation of the Israeli regime's protracted smear campaign targeting Palestinian civil society organizations supported by the U.S. Rather than repairing the world, as Biden and Lapid claim in their joint declaration, the pact will further entrench the Israeli regime apartheid, according to Al-Haq. Al-Haq is one of six Palestinian organizations declared as terrorist group by the Zionist regime last year on the basis of secret evidence. The foreign ministries of several European governments that fund those organizations issued a rare joint statement ahead of Biden's visit to the occupied Palestinian territories, rejecting the terror designations and affirming their support of the targeted groups. Nearly two dozen U.S. lawmakers wrote to Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, to express their serious concern for the six Palestinian groups. A reported lack of evidence to support this decision raises concerns that it may be a deeply repressive measure designed to criminalize and silence prominent and essential Palestinian human rights organizations, the letter from the members of Congress led by Ayanna Pressley states. The U.S. must condemn any effort anywhere to undermine life-saving humanitarian work. The lawmakers urge Blinken to publicly reject this decision and call on the Israeli regime to reverse course. More than 140 organizations signed on in support of the letter, including the six Palestinian organizations, Human Rights Watch, Oxfam America, the Israeli lobby group J Street, and Presbyterian Church USA. Evidently, Biden did not raise the Zionist regime's terror designations against the Palestinian groups, a widely condemned move during his visit. Three of those groups, including Al-Damir Al-Haq and Defense for Children International Palestine, are closely engaged with the International Criminal Court's investigation of war crimes in the West Bank and Gaza. They are likely being targeted because of that work and not despite it.
Biden's reaffirmation that the U.S. will help the Israeli regime undermine the ICC investigation can only be seen as a tacit endorsement of the criminalization of the Palestinian groups representing victims at the court. Reassured that the U.S. will combat efforts to burst Israeli regime impunity at the UN and ICC, Tel Aviv is surely feeling emboldened to escalate its repression. The Israeli regime war ministry reportedly sent a letter to three lawyers representing some of the six Palestinian organizations stating that they may be in violation of Israel's terror laws for collecting fees from the groups. Reporters like Shirin Abu Aghile are also more vulnerable after Biden's West Asia region tour. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, the U.S. effectively shrugged its shoulders over the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, did not push for the release of journalists jailed in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and did not commit to an FBI-led investigation into the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghile. Sharif Mansour, a program coordinator with the Press Safety Watchdog, stated, adding, "Journalists in the region and the world are sadly more vulnerable after this trip."
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The new Prime Minister of the Zionist entity in Palestine is Yair Lapid. He's the 14th Prime Minister to head the regime since the creation of the entity in 1948. Like all the others, Lapid traces his origins to Eastern Europe, to Hungary and Romania to be precise. Yet these white Europeans claim to have a special right to occupy Palestine. In this episode of Palestine Declassified, we'll trace the national origins of Zionist leaders and examine their attempt to justify the occupation of Palestine. To set the scene and spark the discussion, we've got this special report from Bianca Rahimi.
There is a rising tide of claims from apologists for the crimes of Zionism. They say they have been misunderstood. Palestinians might be indigenous to Palestine, but the Jews definitely are. What is called the Israel-Palestine conflict is a conflict over the same small piece of land by two rival indigenous people. But how true is this, and what are the consequences of the argument? In fact, most of the power structure of Israel is dominated by Ashkenazi Jews, who have no ancestral link to Palestine. Overall, despite very significant financial and infrastructural contributions from Western European countries, especially the US, UK and France, for example, via the Rothschild family, Eastern European Ashkenazim have been at the center of the Zionist power structure since the early years of the 20th century. For example, most members of the Jewish National Council in Palestine prior to the founding of Israel in 1948 were Ukrainian. As is well known, key leaders of the Zionist movement hailed from Ukraine. Many, but not all, Ukrainian Zionists were close to the Ukrainian nationalist movement. For example, the far-right revisionist Zionist Vladimir Yevgenovich Yabotinsky was himself a direct descendant of Ukrainian Jewish settlers in Odessa. He famously consorted with the leader of the Ukrainian nationalists,
Simon Petliura,
a proto-Nazi responsible for the pogroms against the Jews and others. Arguably, Zionism and Ukrainian nationalism share certain affinities, which perhaps helps to contextualize the Zionist regime's ongoing support for the Zelensky regime. As early as January 2022, Israel began planning to transfer Ukrainian Jews to become colonists in the land of the Palestinians. Israel's Ministry of Aliyah and Immigrant Absorption proclaimed, "We call on the Jews of Ukraine to immigrate to Israel, your home." A later Zionist colonist from Ukraine, who was prime minister of the Zionist entity from 1969 to 1974, was Golda Mabovich. She claimed, "I'm a Palestinian," but also denied that the Palestinian people ever existed.
"I'm a Palestinian. From 21 until 48, I carried a Palestinian passport."
All in all, seven of the 14 Zionist prime ministers so far came directly from Russia, Poland, Ukraine, or Belarus. The other seven were children of parents from modern Ukraine and or Belarus. Ariel Sharon, Ehud Olmert, Yitzhak Rabin. Lithuania, Ehud Barak. Poland, Benjamin Netanyahu. Hungary and Romania, Yair Lapid. Or Poland and America, Naftali Bennett. All presidents of the Zionist entity, bar three, came directly or indirectly from Poland, Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, or in one case, Austria. The obsession with proving that the Jews, all of the Jews, are indigenous to Palestine flies in the face of the overwhelming evidence of the settler colonial nature of Zionism and the fact that most of those in charge originate in Eastern Europe. Even the Zionist paper Haaretz has published an article claiming that the argument that Jews are indigenous to Palestine swims in fascist waters.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Tony Greenstein. Tony's a veteran anti-Zionist activist. He's a founding member of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and of Jews for Boycotting Israeli Goods. He's a long-standing anti-fascist and author of A History of Fighting Fascism in Brighton and the South Coast. Tony's a prolific blogger and is about to publish a book titled Zionism During the Holocaust. Welcome to the show. Tony, let me start with you. You've written extensively, haven't you, about the history of the Zionist movement. Do you think many people know the principal leaders of the Zionist movement, or actually from Ukraine and other Eastern European countries?
I'm not sure. Many of them are, but not exclusively. The founder of political Zionism, Theodor Herzl, was a Viennese journalist who worked in Paris. So he was a West European, not an East European. And arguably, Zionism was a West European phenomena directed at ensuring that East European Jews didn't come to Western Europe, but went to Palestine. So although the origins were in Poland and Ukraine, the brains were in many ways in the West.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I was going to ask you, David, whether it's actually true that Zionism originated in Ukraine. I mean, given what Tony said, I mean, what's your thoughts? Well,
in many ways it did. I mean, the Odessa area in Ukraine was a settler colony where Jews came from other parts of the continent and settled there. And then later, many of them moved to Palestine and became part of the occupation of Palestine. Odessa was known as being the gates of Zion. Many of the early Zionists came from Odessa. Jabotinsky, of course, famously was raised there in Odessa. And many of the Zionist youth groups that still exist today started in Ukraine or in modern-day Belarus. So, yes, there is a strong sense in which Ukrainian nationalism and Zionism, grew up in parallel, had something really very similar to each other. And that's an interesting aspect of the way in which Zionism as a form of nationalism has developed, I think.
Mm. I mean, Tony, it seems that there's an attempt by Zionist leaders to sort of deny those European origins. I mean, is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, you see, Zionism is based on the idea that it hates the Jewish diaspora. It wishes to wind it up. So he wishes to forget its origins. I mean, yes, most of them, Ben-Gurion, came from Polonsk, a small town in Poland, for example. But they all changed their names to Hebrewize them, and they all hated the Yiddish, the language that was spoken by the East European Jews. That's why they created a new language, Hebrew, because literally they hated the Galut, as they called it.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, we've just seen in the film, David, that many of the Zionist leaders changed the names in the process of becoming settler colonialists, didn't they? I mean, how significant do you think that is?
Well, I mean, they changed their names. I mean, Tony was talking about Ben-Gurion. His name was Green, and Golda Meir, she changed her name. Almost all of them changed their name. Jabotinsky changed his name from Vladimir to Zev. So this is a part of a Judaization, Hebrewization of them, so that it would appear that they had some kind of more intimate connection with Palestine than in fact they did. And, of course, it's part of the process of colonization to present themselves as being somehow indigenous to the area, just like the attempt to colonize hummus and falafel as being Israeli cuisine. Yeah. These are all part of the same thing. It's part of the process of colonization was the changing of the name.
Yeah. I mean, Tony, does your work on the Holocaust and Zionism help us to understand the national origins of Zionism?
It's a good question. I'm not sure it does. My work on the Holocaust really shows how the main priority of the Zionist movement during the Holocaust was building a Jewish state. What was happening to the Jews inside Europe is very much a secondary matter. Not only was it a secondary matter, but when people tried to find a place of refuge for the Jews who managed to flee from Hitler's inferno, the Zionists opposed it on the basis that, well, if you could save Jews somewhere else, what was the point in having a Jewish state? That was the logic, if you can call it that, they followed.
I mean, David, tell us about Golda Meir's description of herself as a Palestinian.
Well, you saw that in the film there. It's an interview from a British TV programme from some years ago. I'm a Palestinian. And she was Ukrainian. And, she moved to the States and then to Palestine. And she talks about it in terms of the passport that she had between 1921 and 1948. She had a Palestinian passport. And she goes on to talk about how there was no such thing as Palestinians. So she says, on the one hand, I was Palestinian. And on the other hand, there was no such thing as Palestinians. There were only Jews and Arabs. And that's an interesting way of putting it, I thought, because, of course, many of the Jews were Arabs. And this is an attempt to suggest that Jews and Arabs were not the same thing. So there's an attempt here, as part of the colonizing project, to present Jews as being something entirely different from the local people.
I mean, I'm sure the discussion that we're having today will be seen as very controversial by the Zionist lobby, and no doubt will be accused of indulging in anti-Semitism again. I wonder, perhaps, David, how would you respond to those charges, maybe preempt some of the criticisms that we're almost bound to get for providing some factual, historical background to this whole discussion?
You can't run away from this. This is the history of the colonization of Palestine. This is not about Jews in general. This is about specific groups of people who came to colonize Palestine. Some of them came, most of them came initially from Europe, or origins in Europe, and then others came laterally from North Africa and from other parts of West Asia. And these people were completely different people. They were a completely different ethnic group. Mm. They happened to share Judaism as a religion. And so there's an attempt in this historical process to flatten that distinction, to make it out as if there was only one Jewish people and that they had their roots historically in Palestine, which, of course, turns out not to have been true.
I mean, Tony, you're Jewish yourself, a son of a rabbi who confronted Oswald Mosley's fascists at the Battle of Cable Street. I mean, you know, is this a case of Jewish exceptionalism, do you think, with the way in which, how the kind of Zionist lobby respond to discussions like this?
Well, yes. I mean, Zionism is a movement based on Jewish exceptionalism, that whatever anyone who's Jewish does cannot be criticised. But the essence of Zionism in Palestine was that it was a Western European colonisatory movement, and in fact, they weren't even aware most of them, of the fact there were Arab Jews. No, and Arthur Rupin, who was maybe the most important personality in Palestinian Zionism before the Second World War, he was a social Darwinist. He believed in survival of the fittest, and he had this belief that the West European Zionists and Jews were not Semitic, unlike the Arab Jews. And so for the hard labour in Palestine, he employed Yemenite Jews. But because of his pathological, eugenicism, they were paid starvation wages. They weren't given medical care. So 50% of the Yemenite workers died off. They died off like flies because they had this attitude to them that they were the untermenschen. They were not fully human beings.
Well, let's just pause the discussion there for a moment, because we've got another report now that examines the historical origins of the two main groups of Jews in the world today.
Zionists increasingly deploy the idea that the Jews, considered as one indivisible people, are indigenous to Palestine. The term decolonized Judean is used by Zionists, often white Europeans, to describe themselves. But is there any remnant of the original Jewish people expelled 2,000 years ago amongst the two major groups of Jews in the world today? The dominant group, massively overrepresented at all levels of the power structure in what is called Israel today, are Ashkenazi Jews. Recent research in linguistics and genetics shows that the Rhineland hypothesis, which suggests that Ashkenazim comes from the Levant and Yiddish originates in Germany, is unable to explain the genetic, linguistic, and cultural data now available. It suggests instead an Iranian Turkish Slavic origin for Ashkenazi Jews and a Slavic origin for Yiddish. A killer detail in the argument is the existence of, along the ancient Silk Road trade route in northeastern Turkey, of four primeval villages whose names resemble Ashkenaz, such as Ishkenaz. Ashkenazi Jews then appear to have no historical connection to the original Jews of Palestine. The Sephardi Jews are the second main group of Jews in the world. They're increasingly populous, and according to some accounts, now make up a majority of Jews in occupied Palestine. But they also face a well-known pattern of discrimination in relation to the white European Ashkenazi Jews. When they arrived in occupied Palestine, mostly after 1948, these groups often spoke a kind of Arabic and were sometimes referred to as Arab Jews. This was a threat to Zionism, which made sure to discourage their use of Arabic and assiduously worked to de-racialize them. Some left Zionists and anti-Zionist groups tried to present the Sephardim as a benighted ethnic minority. But if the aim is to wean Sephardim away from ultra-Zionism, this is a strategy doomed to failure. Once they become settler colonists and their connections with the Arabs were severed, their primary loyalty came to be the Zionist project. But this cannot erase the fact that the Sephardim are Arab Jews, as is widely accepted in the humanities and social science research literature. Even more pointedly, linguistic and genetic research shows that these so-called indigenous Jews are predominantly descendant from North African Berbers and Arabs. The truth is that Ashkenazi Jews come mostly from Eastern Europe, with origins in the Caucasus, Turkey, and Iran. Sephardim are mostly of Arabic, Berber, and some European origins. They are Arab Jews, with perhaps as little connection to Palestine as the Ashkenazim. There is no unitary Jewish people with any historically continuous claim to the land of Palestine.
David, what's the background to the academic and scientific literature that's overturned the idea that Ashkenazi Jews originated in Germany?
Well, there's a guy called Wexler, Paul Wexler, who's a linguist at an Israeli university. And he's written several books on this topic. And he's been joined more laterally by a number of others, including a number of other Israeli Jewish social scientists and scientists who have done this kind of a geographical population studies, which have shown the way in which the Ashkenazi Jews originated along the trade route, or the Silk Road trade route, in northeast Turkey, coming up from Iran, through Turkey, and over towards the west. And the work that they've done is stunning, really, if you look at the data which underlies it, and in particular showing the Slavic origin of Yiddish, which they then say was relexified to German, i.e. most of the German vocabulary was replaced, the original vocabulary, but the language itself is Slavic in origin. So this suggests that the Ashkenazi Jews are Slavic, Iranian, Turkish in original origin, and don't have any real connection to Palestine, to the Jews who were expelled back in 70 AD. So it's a really interesting scientific dispute, and there is a dispute about it, but increasingly it looks like the dispute has been won, and it's becoming a common position.
Sure. I mean, Tony, what's your view on this debate? I mean, how do Zionists react to the idea that Yiddish is actually a Slavic language?
I don't really know. I mean, I'm not sure that it's particularly relevant. I mean, Zionism makes many claims about the biological, the genetic, the racial, if you like, origins in Palestine. And to be quite honest, it really does not matter. There were 2,000, 3,000 years ago, there were many peoples, Canaanites, Moabites, you name it, Edomites, who were wandering over the land. The idea that you can now make a claim based on a particular group of people who lived in Palestine 2,000 plus years ago is absurd. I suspect if the West Bank settlers met the original Hebrews, they would be shot on sight as terrorists. I mean, that is the reality. It's a complete rewriting of history back into time. So I'm really not at all worried about it because it's completely bogus. Western colonists have always justified their presence in other people's lands by virtue of the Bible or other religious texts.
Mm. I mean, I've got to say, David, this discussion about the origins of these Sephardic Jews was kind of new to me. I mean, perhaps you could say a little bit more about that.
Well, again, this is this guy Wexler, who's a linguist, and he's done this research. He's written a book on this, a whole book on it, showing that the Sephardic Jews... the word is Hebrew for Spanish, so right. It's supposed to be Spanish and Portuguese Jews. Right. And actually, that contrary to this conception, the ethnic origin and the genetic origins of these populations is in North Africa, and from Berber and Arabic stock, and some European stock as well, with a really small component of the original Palestinian Jews from back in the day. So even the ones, the Sephardim, who are regarded as being kind of indigenous to Palestine, don't have a clear claim to that, and actually descend from the Berbers and from Arabs. These are Arabs, and there shouldn't be a distinction between between Arab and Jew in the way that there currently is in much debate.
Mm. I mean, certainly this notion of Arabic Jews seems to be quite widespread in academic literature. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, firstly, I mean, what you call Arab Jews often aren't Arab Jews. I mean, I'm no expert in the different ethnicities, but I understand Berbers are not Arabs and neither are Kurds. But there are Jews heavily concentrated amongst both groups. So Jews were indigenous, if you like, to Arabia, but not particularly to Palestine. They dispersed. I mean, David said... the Jews were expelled in 70 AD. I have to say, this is a Zionist myth. There is no evidence whatsoever that there was any expulsion. This, is history being rewritten back in order to justify a colonialist narrative. So, yes, of course, but you know what happened when the Arab Jews were brought to Israel after destabilization, because Zionism destabilized the community in Iraq, Morocco, etc. They were de-Arabized. They were treated as dirt. You look what happened to the Yemenite Jews. Thousands of their babies were stolen, literally, in the hospital. They were told they were dead. And then they were given to either American or Israeli Ashkenazi parents. And some of them were subject to quite horrific medical experiments. Yeah. I mean, all of this has come out despite three white inquiries. So they were treated as dirt. They were recreated. They were de-Arabized. That is the reality of what happens.
I mean, briefly, David, we haven't got much time left. Arabic Jews, Jews of Arabic origin, do face discrimination. Do you think that, gives us a prospect of a serious challenge to Zionism or not?
I think not. I mean, I think that there is a feeling among some in the Zionist left and some in the anti-Zionist left that might be something to work on. But, you know, I think if you compare it with other settler colonial situations, like especially the question of Ireland, you know, the settlers, especially the working class in the settlers, are the ones who become the most devoted and the most extreme. And that certainly is the case with Ulster loyalism. And I think probably it's also seemed to be the case with Sephardic Jews inside the state of Israel.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now as we're right out of time. Thank you to Tenny Greenstein and to you, David Miller, our resident expert, for joining us today. And we'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight. Britain's Met Office expects the month of August to be dry in the south and southeast of England. It added July 2022 has been the driest July in England since 1911, with only 24% of the amount of rain that would normally be expected to fall. We have prepared for you an article written by Helena Horton. The piece is titled Millions May Face Hosepipe Ban After England's Driest July Since 1911. Please stay with us for more of Helena Horton's article. Millions of Britons could spend